Welcome and thank you all for joining today's conference. All participant lines have been placed in listen-only mode until the question and answer session. To ask a question, press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. And now I'd like to turn today's conference over to Jenny Lyons. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Sarah, and good afternoon, everyone. Yes, my name is Jenny Lyons, and I'm with NOAA Public Affairs, and I just want to start by thanking you all for joining us on this call today. We're here to announce new data on high tide flooding in the United States, and to explain the news we're releasing today, I have the honor of introducing our speakers. First, sharing the meat of the information is Nicole LaBeouf. Nicole is our acting director of NOAA's National Ocean Service. She's going to provide a brief summary of our news, and then we will open for questions. We also have some other experts on hand to answer your questions, including Greg Dusek. He's the chief scientist for NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services, and William Sweet, an oceanographer for NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services. You can find specific names and spellings and title information for our experts on the media advisory posted at NOAA.gov. And just a reminder that this call is for working media only. If you're not a member of the press, you're absolutely welcome to listen, but please do not ask questions, as this time is really reserved for reporters. With that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Nicole. Nicole, please go ahead.
Thanks, Jenny, and good afternoon, everyone. As Jenny indicated, my name is Nicole LaBeouf. I'm the acting director of NOAA's National Ocean Service. Today, we released a report documenting record-breaking coastal flooding, or high tide flooding, caused by sea level rise this past year and that is expected to continue into next year. Let's start by defining high tide flooding, also sometimes called nuisance or sunny day flooding. This happens when tides reach anywhere from 1.75 to 2 feet above the daily average high tide, causing water to spill onto streets or bubble up from storm drains that aren't built to handle this much water. As sea level rise continues, damaging floods that decades ago happened only during a storm now happen more regularly, even without severe weather, such as during a full moon tide or with a change in wind and currents. NOAA has tide gauges across the United States, making up the National Water Level Observation Network. Some tide gauges have been recording water level data for over 100 years. This network supports safe shipping and tracks a dangerous storm surge, and it also monitors the steady creep of sea level rise and a rapid uptick in high tide flooding. Our 2019 State of High Tide Flooding Report brings together data recorded at 98 NOAA tide gauges between May 2019 and April 2020. It shows us that U.S. coastal communities saw a median flood frequency of 4 days in 2019, just shy of the record set last year. Some communities saw more flooding than others. In 2019, Charleston suffered 13 days of damaging flood levels compared to about 2 days in the year 2000. In my home state of Texas, Sabine Pass and Corpus Christi had 21 and 18 days of flooding in 2019, where they saw only about 1 and 3 days, respectively, in 2000. That's 21 days where there was 1 day before and 18 days where there were three, just such a dramatic change in less than two decades. Indeed, conditions are changing, and not just in a few locations. The second part of today's announcement is the National High Tide Outlook. This report projects that U.S. coastal communities will see 2 to 6 days of flooding on average between this May and next April. By 2030, long-term projections show 7 to 15 days of high tide flooding for coastal communities nationally. By 2050, that number rises to 25 to 75 days, suggesting that high tide flood levels may become the new high tide in some locations. You see where this is going. We all need to pay attention. The good news is that NOAA data is delivering, gives us the information needed so that coastal communities can make informed decisions about how to handle disruptive flooding this next year and for decades. This information is needed to protect life, property, and the economy, and our environment for future generations. As towns, states, and the federal government, along with the public, increasingly turn our attention to the impacts of coastal inundation and related hazards, NOAA's Ocean Service is the authoritative source of data and information on a wide range of these risks. We are not just a data provider, however, our people and our facilities are an integral part of many of the coastal communities at risk. That makes the National Ocean Service a truly invested partner at the center of the national conversation on sea level rise. With that, I thank you all for joining us today, and I will turn the call back over to Jenny Lyons, who will facilitate questions and answers.
Thank you so much, Nicole. At this time, we're going to open for your reporter questions. Sarah, can you please explain the process for asking a question?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please unmute your phone, press star 1, and state your name when prompted. You may withdraw your request by pressing star 2. Again, for questions, please press star 1 at this time. One moment, please, for questions to queue.
Thank you, Sarah. It looks like our first question comes from Seth with the Associated Press. Seth, we're opening up your line.
Thank you. Nicole, I can't help but notice that the words climate change don't appear in this entire report on sea level rise flooding. Was this edited by political appointees? Why does a report about sea level rise not mention climate change or global warming? And in terms of the outlook, it says it's based on a ENSO neutral outlook for the year, where as of last week, the Climate Prediction Center put us on a La Nina watch. And how will that change all this if we go into the forecasted La Nina? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your question. And I'm going to start with the first part and leave the ENSO question to our experts. I will say that climate change and carbon emissions are a factor at play when we look at how tides are rising. But what this report focuses on is the data being collected from the tide gauges across the country. So it's a little different topic. They are complementary to one another, but we were really trying to chronicle the data being collected and make future projections based on that information. But I would be happy to turn the climate assessment, the national climate assessment, and the ENSO question over to our scientists.
Yes, hi, Seth. This is William Sweet. Yep, good point there. We look like we may be headed into a La Nina. When we make the outlook, we use the May plume from the multimodal ensemble that showed more of an ENSO neutral. The neutral and La Nina conditions both are provide about the same outlook on the East Coast, so we don't expect those outlook to really change at all. It's really El Nino that really drives up the flooding on top of any underlying trend that occurs. Along the West Coast, a La Nina may suggest water levels might be lower than normal, than trend values. So this could lessen the risk of flooding. So if indeed a full-strength La Nina would materialize, though the outlook on the West Coast is pretty mild to begin with, not much flooding actually happens on the West Coast. We may actually go back and update and make sure that the range are still valid. But for right now, ENSO and La Nina pretty much are similar in the way that the flooding would manifest. So our outlook, we're confident in the outlook.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Christopher at the New York Times. Christopher, your line is now open.
Yeah, hi, it's Chris Lavelle from The Times. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to ask what the headline finding here is. You mentioned, ma'am, at the top that it was a record-breaking year. I just want to understand how you mean it's a record-breaking year. Certainly there were individual tide stations that that had record-breaking levels of high tide flooding, but is that, I mean, what is the top line finding? What's the biggest takeaway here, aside from just a continuation of a trend that was already underway?
Hi, this is William Sweet. I think, you know, the national takeaway here is when we look at the frequency of flooding nationally across the country, we were not record-breaking. We tied for the second highest on record. But the underlying trend is one that's accelerating. What was a nationally broken record was when we do a median value of sea level rise along the United States coastline in the last 100 years, last year we hit the highest value on record, over a foot higher than it was since 1920 or 100 years ago. So that really testifies that, you know, it's this drive in sea level rise that is really pumping up the water levels and causing more flooding to occur. As you mentioned, there are individual locations that broke records, but that's to be expected. This is the new normal. It's a floodier future. It's happening now. Sea level rise impacts already stacking up. 19 locations tied or broke their records for flooding, including areas like Annapolis, Charleston, Savannah, Miami, five out of seven locations along the Texas coastline. So some very important areas are really starting to see flooding, and it's really driving change and conversation in these locations. So, you know, I think that's the real takeaway.
Okay, and then thank you for that. That does help. Just to echo the question we had previously, I'm sorry to push on this, but were there any political staff involved in vetting or reviewing this report or document before it was released today?
Yeah, this is Nicole. There was not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian at Bloomberg.
Hi, thanks, guys, for taking the call. I'm interested in the situation in New York. I mean, do you have any details on what happened in New York, how it stacked up? Did it break any records? How many days, et cetera? I didn't get the have a chance to look at the report yet. I just got it a few minutes before we get on the call here. So.
Sure. This is William Sweet again. New York experienced, let's say, the Battery or Kingsport, Montauk. You know, there are several tide gauges that we're looking at there. None of them actually broke individual records. However, there was a significant amount of flooding, 10 days last year, let's say, at the Battery, which really might really reflect flooding that might be going on in Jamaica Bay and some of those real vulnerable neighborhoods over by the airport. Sea levels, though, continue their uptick there as well. So we had some record-breaking sea levels there, though, again, it's not the mean sea level that's always driving. It's the cause of the increase in flooding, but it's really also a combination of where were we in the, you know, some of our tidal cycles, you know, what was the storminess conditions, et cetera. So not record-breaking, but still undergoing the trend when we look through time in New York and elsewhere along the majority of the East and Gulf Coast, more than 75% of those locations on a year-to-year basis, when we characterize the changes in high tide flooding, it's an upward sloping, it's an accelerating trend. So the annual frequencies are growing in leaps and bounds. It's not a steady or linear rise. It's really, it's taken off, and that it continued last year, though it wasn't record-breaking per se in that one particular year.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kim Miller at the Palm Beach Post. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. So I'm focused on Virginia Key, obviously. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on why it broke the record. Was there something happening, possibly Dorian last year, that increased the number of flooding days? And then follow up, why does it seem like we're going down afterwards? So the projection for the upcoming year is lower, and then even in like 2030, I think it's only 2 to something 5 days.
Right. Thank you. William Sweet again. You know, any given year can deviate from the trend. So next year, the outlook is 3 to 6 days, whereas last year they experienced 9. These outlooks are really based upon trend fits, and in this case, it would be a quadratic trend. But though it considers what happens last year, it will not necessarily say that that's going to be repetitive. So it tries to capture the baseline shifts that are occurring. And when we project out to 2030, we're using two sea level rise scenarios that are considered sort of more likely outcomes, and they really are kind of bounding the interannual variability that's occurring today. So it really sort of balanced the problem nicely. And it's supposed to represent sort of on average, not in any given year, but on average. So if you look historically at what's occurred at Virginia Key, that last year's value might be an outlier, it's a standout event in terms of its value. But, we don't always expect those standout years to be higher some years, lower the next, and it's really trying to characterize the change in baseline. It's not to say that we may be underestimating the amount of flooding that may occur in a decade from now, but we will reevaluate the trajectory that locations are on. If sea levels really tend to really pick up, then we'll reevaluate and we'll make a new assessment.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Martin at the Orange County Register. Go ahead, you're open.
Hi, I'm calling from Southern California, and I have two questions. The first is, could you give a general explanation of why the high tide flooding is more extreme in some places over the past year or over any year than it is in other places? Why are we seeing more extreme events in the Gulf and the East Coast than on the West Coast? And my second question is, could you explain the difference between, there's language in here that discusses accelerating trends and increasing trends, and could you explain the distinction between accelerating and increasing?
Absolutely. This is William Sweet. The first part of your question is, why is there so much more flooding on sort of the East and Gulf Coast than the West Coast for the most part?
Right.
And that's largely due to the topographic and bathymetric characteristics of the East Coast and Gulf Coast. There's a very shallow, wide continental shelf, and when winds blow, it's very easy to stack up water levels. So I live in an area that's Annapolis. It's very windy. It's a good place to sail. It's not uncommon for water levels to rise up a foot or two above normal with just a 15 or 20 knot wind. On the West Coast, it's a very narrow, deep continental shelf. It just doesn't allow storm surges or wind setup events to occur. Your variability, besides the tide, your variability is less. What you do have on the West Coast is you have wave effects. Now, these high tide flood days really don't consider waves. They really are what the tide gauges measure, and typically the tide gauges aren't in the breaking surf environment. So on the West Coast right now, it's really that large swell wave attacking the beaches, causing dunes and bluffs to collapse, overwash events. So that's sort of the one of the main differences. The other is that the East and Gulf Coast have much higher rates of sea level rise right now. The West Coasts are starting to pick up, but that's just regional distinctions. And in terms of your second part of the question, you know, what's the difference between an accelerating or just an increasing? And we were trying to make it as easy to understand as possible. But in the very plain statistics, is one's a straight line fit that's rising, but it's not a curve, whereas the accelerating would be one that's better characterized by a curving upward sloping line, and we call that accelerating. So the rate is changing through time. So a linear increase, you would expect sort of a gradual, sort of monotonic, meaning, you know, gradual increasing through time, where you're accelerating really is, don't, last year and last decade isn't the best indicator of what's coming next. You know, it's really growing in the leaps and bounds, the 2, 4, 8, 16 type of characterization.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Frank at E&E News. Tom, your line is now open.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Nicole, you said that climate change and carbon emissions are a factor at play when we look at how tides are rising.
how much of a factor and how are they a factor? But how much, other than saying a factor? Be more specific, please.
Well, I'm going to let our scientists answer that because I do know that in different parts of the country, the relative factors have different levels of importance, whether it's absolute sea level rise or subsidence, et cetera. So if Billy, if you want to take that and sir, for your question, if you have a specific location, we might be able to narrow in on the relative importance of the different factors.
Sure. You know, anthropogenic influences are at play. So typically folks think of, you know, climate warming, ocean and atmospheric warming definitely drives sea level rise. Currently, one third of the global rise is associated with thermal expansion. The water's the ocean's actually absorbing heat and it's expanding. Two thirds of the contribution from the global rise rate right now is due to melting of land-based ice in Greenland and Antarctica mountain glaciers. The global rate right now is about an inch every 8 years, and that rate has been increasing over this century. There's been numerous modeling studies that were reported in the fourth National Climate Assessment that show that a significant majority of heating and therefore sea level rise in the last 30 to 50 years is attributable to human influences. Again, this is, you know, the climate assessment of studies that are going on. So we know it's important, but we also know that there's a lot of variability in the ocean in terms of, you know, tides and storms, that there's several processes going on at once. So though it's a contribution, it's not the only thing that we're measuring. There's also another usually overlooked contribution that humans have is we extract groundwater. As well as fossil fuels offshore and near shore. And that's an important contribution in areas along the mid-Atlantic, let's say, where a lot of municipalities are getting their drinking water from subsurface aquifers. And when you pump that water, it makes the land compact and land sink. And that's an important contribution as well. So there's lots of land management practices that are contributing to sea level rise and the flooding that we're experiencing. But we do know through the documented record of observations, both through tide gauges and satellite, but also the geological record, that there's a tight coupling between heating, ocean heat, atmospheric heat, carbon dioxide, and sea levels, and they tend to move together in tandem. So when we project into the future, it's a consideration. These models are bounded by what we think likely could happen. But again, we're trying to use the more likely outcomes. Nothing to be alarmist about, but saying here's the trajectory we appear to be on. If communities are flooding more often, they're asking for information about next year and the next few decades, and we're trying to give them the best estimate with the data that we have in hand so they can make the very best decisions as they move forward.
Sarah, go ahead.
Thank you. This is the operator. At this time, please press star 1. Again, please press star 1. Even if you had pressed star 1 previously, please repress star 1 to join back into the queue.
All right. I think the next question that was in line before we lost the queue was Tim Wheeler. Tim, if you can just press star 1, Sarah will pull your name back up to the top. And then I apologize, the list is starting over in the new order of who's pressed star 1.
Okay. This is Tim Wheeler. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
We hear you, Tim. Please go ahead.
Yes, I noticed that there are 6 sites in the Chesapeake Bay set new records for frequency of high tide flooding last year. And I guess that's 6 out of the 19 on the eastern Gulf Coast. I'm wondering if there's a sort of a regional variation within the in terms of this high tide flooding, or was that just a fluke that year? Also wondering about the Washington, D.C. station, which had reported 22 days at one time, but nowhere near that since. Is that, again, just a quirk of the weather at that time and heavy rainfall? What?
Absolutely. Nice question. This is William Sweet. the Chesapeake Bay is unique on the East Coast. Due to its orientation, it's both as much of the East Coast, it's sensitive to northerly winds. The winds blow out of the north due to the spin of the earth. It tends to push water up along the East Coast. So that's why the nor'easters are such a concern for flooding. In that case, it's more of a real strong localized storm. But winds out of the north tend to set water up along the whole East Coast. But the Chesapeake Bay, the way it's oriented, winds from the south also push water up into the bay and can cause flooding. So not only are the northerly winds causing waters to set up in the Chesapeake Bay as well as the rest of the East Coast, southerly winds cause the same phenomena within the bay. So they really have two sets of winds that are both quite common driving flooding in the bay. And that's why we tend to really see some high numbers year after year. The variability of water level is extreme along the East Coast. The Washington, D.C. gauge is similar to a few others that we have around the country, Wilmington, North Carolina, that they actually are a tidal river, but also are sensitive to downstream freshwater outflow. They're a river, a major river. And so that 22 of days that was its record that did not occur last year was partially picking up the extreme rainfalls in the discharge that was occurring. I think that was a year or two ago. So they are unique in that they also feel and measure some rainfall and river contributions directly.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Elizabeth at Reveal. Elizabeth, we are just opened your line.
Thank you. I'm curious if you can say more about your projections in relation to climate change. When you make your projections for sea level rise in the future, how much of the increase that you project is due to effects of climate change versus the other effects you might be seeing that aren't related to climate change?
This is William Sweet. When we make our projections into 2030, as well as in 2050, the scenarios for sea level rise that we use at NOAA, we provide a range of plausible outcomes by the end of the century. But within the next few decades, most of those scenarios that do have emission underpinning, so they may equate to high emissions, reduced emissions, drastic cutback in emissions, none of those scenarios really deviate that much in the next couple decades. Not to say that they don't at the end of the century or into the 2200 and so forth, but we have much more confidence that what will really be driving change over the next 10 to 30 years is variability stacked up on sea level rise. In this case, the 2050 projections are based upon a global rise amount of somewhere between 0.75, 3/4 of a foot, and 1 foot, as measured by year 2000 values. That's when these projections start. And so when we overlay our observations onto these two scenarios, we find that it's largely within that range right now. And so it gives us confidence when we project out to give sort of the nearer term planning over the next couple decades. We do project out to 2100. We don't in this effort, and we provide several scenarios for it. Just really depends on your risk tolerance as you move forward. If you have something that can't fail, then you may have a much smaller risk tolerance. You want to succeed under any type of uncertainty that exists, whereas other types of planning may not need as much built-in tolerance, let's say. But in the near term, there's not much deviation between the trajectory of sea level rise that we're on now, and that's why we sort of provided out not just next year to help in preparations of how much response, how many days of flooding, and what's that response going to be, the costs associated with that communities are dealing with, but in a few decades from now so they can really get a better understanding of when really might they consider major upgrades to just get ahead of the flooding problem altogether.
And let me, this is Greg Dusek. I just want to chime in on Billy's answer. And just to mention that, I think it's important to realize that even with the lower sea level rise scenarios, like Billy mentioned, we could be on a linear sea level rise case and even the lowest, kind of possible scenario that we that is envisioned, and we're still going to see an acceleration in the number of high tide flood days. So I think it's just important to realize that, you know, it's not just this kind of long-term, what seems to be slow change in sea level rise, in mean sea level rise, but it's really the intersection of that with the tides. And because of that relationship, the importance of the tides, we're going to see, you know, regardless of what happens in terms of scenario, we're going to see an acceleration at many of these locations, or continue to see really an acceleration at many of these tide gauges across the U.S.
Thank you, Greg. That's Billy again, William Sweet. And just to push one other side is that these scenarios we're using are actually what were adopted for the fourth National Climate Assessment. So other agencies are using these as well. And so they're sort of put out in the best faith of saying this is what's likely to unfold in the next few decades. So for planning and preparedness purposes, these would be the ones that folks would tend to be using.
Thank you both. Our next question comes from Joe at the Press of Atlantic City.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the time today. Just one question for you here. So I'm looking at the assessment and focusing on New Jersey, of course, Atlantic City and Cape May. And I see the peak high tide flooding season for the fall. You know, given that nor'easters typically are between the months of November through March and even April here, can you just go into a little bit more of where you get that fall season from and just elaborate on that a little bit? Thanks so much.
Absolutely. This is William Sweet, and I think Greg Dusick will probably have a follow-up. The fall tends to be the peak season for much of the East Coast. As you mentioned, the nor'easter, the real localized nor'easters, yes, they tend to come a little bit more in the wintertime. However, the fall, there's two components to it. One, you do have a change of seasons occurring, and you definitely have a pickup in winds as well. You tend to get more northerly winds. It may not be a full a blown low-pressure nor'easter event, but you do have a change in season and the winds are picking up. But there's an important seasonal cycle that's occurring as well within mean sea level. Not only is mean sea level changing and rising year to year to year across the decades, but within a year, sea level is higher when the water is warmer. And we tend to find our peak warmth through the thermal momentum occurs sort of in that August, September timeframes. It also has an association with the Gulf Stream and its transport. So in short, sea levels are higher in the fall time than they are in the winter time. And that difference can be in the New Jersey coastlines, usually on the order of about a half foot. In some places, it can be closer to a foot as you head south in areas like South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, and some areas on the Gulf Coast. So that's significant. When the higher tides of the season occur in the fall, they're operating under a higher water level. When the winds begin to really blow in September and October, they're operating under a higher water level. The flood risk is greater.
Yeah, and this is Greg Dusek. I just want to add something there in terms of, you know, that seasonal information is also something we provide at NOAA through our office. We have a product called the High Tide Bulletin, which we put out every season, and that focuses on these kind of seasonal patterns and the influences of the tides, like Billy mentioned, and projects what days and what locations you're most likely to see flooding occur in the season ahead. And so right now we're in the summer season, so that outlook is available, and come the end of August, we'll be releasing the bulletin for the fall. And so, if you know, as you approach those seasons, if you're interested in what specific days flooding is likely to occur, I would encourage you to check out that product as well.
Thank you. Our next question comes again from Seth with the Associated Press. Seth, please go ahead with your follow-up.
Billy, not to push to beat a dead horse here, but is there a way you can just give me a rough percentage, some kind of number in general nationally on, not on how much of the sea level rise is climate change? I think we're all familiar with that. Is how much of the high tide flooding is caused by sea level rise, which is from climate change? Is it 80%? Is it 20%? Is it 90%? In other words, how big a factor is climate change, relative sea level rise here in high tide flooding?
Well, that's a challenging question, Seth, to actually answer. The studies that I mentioned earlier really are aimed at global sea levels. When you get down to the regional and when you get down to the local, which sort of a national number would be a summation of you know, localized values, to really try to tease out an anthropogenic signal locally or even regionally is sort of beyond the science right now. That's still sort of cutting edge. The models are really just trying to understand how heat capacity of the ocean or the heat uptake of the oceans has been changing in the last couple decades due to the heating that's occurred, and they do the counterfactual simulations of heating with less emissions to more emissions. So it's still a science question on a global basis. It's not mature enough to really get at that locally. There was a study done by Climate Central three or four years ago where they used some of these downscaled modeling techniques that looked at that to try to arrive at that the answer that, to your question, how much of the flooding is unnatural. So I would point you there, but still caution that it's beyond the science right now. But the things that are better measured are the rate of land subsidence and compaction due to anthropogenic influences, the withdrawal of fresh water. And I'd point to areas like Norfolk, Virginia, that have recognized that they have a high subsidence rate, largely to groundwater withdrawal. And they've put in wells with the USGS to actually measure this, and they're experimenting with reinjected treated wastewater to stem the compaction that's going on. So it's a better handle on the ground subsidence from human activity than I would say the ocean rise component at a local or even regional level due to anthropogenic warming.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Margie at the Cordova Times. Hi, Margie.
Hi, thanks for having this call. Some areas of Alaska have 30-foot tides, and are certain areas with high tides more vulnerable? And also, how serious an impact do you expect on coastal areas that are already eroding for lack of early winter ice that protects the shoreline? We have a huge area of Alaska that is already seeing the impact of that lack of early sea ice. And some communities, of course, are in the process of or having to move. Thank you.
Sure. This is William Sweet. You bring up a very good question of, you know, the communities in the North Slope of Alaska that the reduction of sea ice is allowing more fetch on the winds, more wave setup and development, and higher rates of erosion and flooding. We have not yet been able to get a handle on the impact thresholds for Alaska. Part of it is obviously it's extremely vast. And the observations to really understand locally how water levels are changing and are expected to continue change, as Greg Dusick had mentioned, with the intersection of tides and winds and waves and sea level change and erosion. It's a complex, but that's something we're going to continue to help monitor and focus on, as well as areas in the Great Lakes that don't have a sea level rise issue but have a flooding and erosion issue as water levels change. So as Alaska continues to change, it's something we're going to have to monitor. The extreme tide range areas of Alaska, you mentioned more in the southeast areas, for the most part, sea levels there are dropping fairly rapidly due to the melt of local glaciers and isostatic rebound from the last ice age. They have some of the fastest rebound rates that are occurring in the United States. So though they have extreme tides, over the course of the year, sea levels dropping, the tides just aren't reaching quite as high. I think in many of these areas, they will have some flooding concerns, but you almost have a different type of concern that your dock no longer is really near the water sufficiently for access. You know, it's that kind of flip side of the equation. The low water phenomena has become more of an issue. But one thing's for certain, you know, we are going to live near the water. It's very important. It's the lifeline for our commerce and transportation to move goods and services. It's just difficult to get right when sea levels are changing, and there will be different characteristics and complications depending upon regionally where you are. But the way we tackle this is we continue to make observations and do the best science to deliver the information that is locally relevant.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Alex Harris at Miami Health.
Hi there. Have you changed your threshold for flooding from the standardized national number you've used in the past? I see each station has a slightly different height.
Well, very good question. This is William Sweet. We did. And the long story short is we wanted to better normalize the depth of flooding that we were communicating and reporting out on. We are not trying to determine what the local flood risk is everywhere. We work with our National Weather Service, whose job it is through their weather forecasting offices, is to ensure that with the emergency managers locally, that life and property is safe during big storms or small storms. And they have thresholds, which we had originally reported on, that are oftentimes for very specific geographies within a community. But they don't necessarily speak broadly up and down outside of those communities or that cities. And we really would rather make more of a regional and national assessment. So what we did is we found sort of a best fit solution to all their thresholds and found a pattern and started calling this high tide flooding so that we could have a nationally consistent threshold, more of an apples to apples comparison of impacts that would speak to anyone, whether you're on the West Coast or East Coast. As a result, the flood frequencies oftentimes have gone down in certain areas. Deeper floods occur less often than shallower floods, but we don't want to call it a flood if it's not seen. In this case, our high tide flood threshold nationally more or less is always the stormwater infiltration and other subsurface issues, but it tends to be water on the streets that is noticeable, you know, disrupting commerce, traffic and way of life in some of these communities. It's not outright damaging, but it's disruptive, and the cumulative toll of these floodings are starting to stack up, and communities are becoming concerned and spending money to fix these problems, and they're asking NOAA for the best science and guidance as to what to expect next year and the coming decades.
And this is Greg Dusek. I just want to add, too, we did put out a tech report, a NOAA tech report detailing those changes in February of 2018, patterns and projections of high tide flooding along the U.S. coastline using a common impact threshold. And so that details, you know, where our thresholds come from and how we got to those numbers. And so if you're interested in that, I'm sure we can make sure to get that to you.
Thanks. Our next question comes from Kim Miller again at the Palm Beach Post.
Sorry, I was just wondering if you could be more specific about what might have caused the record number of flood days at Virginia Key last year. Was there an incident? Happened? Maybe Hurricane Dorian?
You know, the hurricane played some part for a shorter period of time, maybe a day or two. I need to go back and look at the specific times that occurred. But looking at its record over the course of numerous months, sea levels were upwards of a half foot to a foot higher than otherwise, or you know, above trend values. So much of the southeast and Gulf Coast, not only is sea level rising, and we fit oftentimes historically, we look at this through linear trends, but they were higher than trend values for much of the year. And that was systematic from about the Chesapeake down through the Gulf. And in fact, there was a majority, about 90% of the gauges on the eastern Gulf Coast had the highest sea levels on record. So it wasn't necessarily that there were more storms than normal. You have your seasonal king tides, as they're called, in the fall. You have some Gulf Stream fluctuations, but when sea levels are a foot higher or so than otherwise, you know, these type of typical events garden variety events start causing flooding in the streets. And so it really was that prolonged setup of sea, which is really indicative to the warmer waters, thermal expansion, you know, the things that we're predicting that will occur under these projections are occurring, and in fact, we're flooding more just as we're predicting will occur, and therefore that's why we're given these types of outlooks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jenny at WLRN Public Radio.
Hi, thanks. Could you, and I'm sorry, you may have already talked about this, but could you explain a little bit more about how you forecast and model the acceleration? You know, like here in Miami, it was sort of linear for a while, and then we started accelerating. And again, you may have answered that when you talked about the thermal expansion and warmer waters, but I was wondering if you could just kind of simply explain the acceleration part, because I think that's something that's sort of critical to our listeners.
Absolutely. This is William Sweet. We try to keep it as simple as possible. You know, a simple model is oftentimes much better than a very complex model because it's easier to understand and tweak if needed. The way that we approach the modeling and the projections, let's say for next year in 2020, is we literally make counts on an annual basis. How many days was water level above this threshold, and in this case, the high tide flood threshold, and we then fit a line, a statistical line. So in areas like Virginia Key, we've had measurements since the early 90s, so about 30 years of data or so, and you statistically determine, is it better characterized by a linear fit, by a quadratic fit? And it has to be significant. So again, we have to have a statistical significance to ensure that what we're projecting is not just variability, natural variability, and we're being led astray by an off fit. So it's a simple year-to-year compilation of data, and then we statistically fit it. In the case for Virginia Key, it's best characterized by a quadratic or linear upward sloping fit through time. And they're not alone. The majority of stations now, almost 50 on the East Coast, more than about 75% or so are accelerating as well. So if you're at an elevation at or below this high tide flood threshold, means you're at greater risk for flooding, and that risk is really growing through time. And we put out some maps of these areas that are at potentially exposed to flooding. So you marry up the statistics of saying what's likely to happen next year with maps on the ground showing areas that are potentially in harm's way. You know, it's that kind of sets of information that are really helping communities identify vulnerable areas. And in fact, when they actually see the flooding, it really reinforces and testifies to the fact that these tide gauges are really sort of sentinels at the sea that are measuring changes at hand. And we're using this data to just transform it into guidance next year and for the decades to come.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Chloe at the Post and Courier. Chloe, please go ahead.
Hey, all. Thanks for the call. I wanted to ask again about what made last year so anomalous for the Southeast, and I understand that sea levels, you know, as a baseline were half a foot to a foot higher than we would expect, making this flooding more likely. But is that entirely thermal expansion? Because I don't recall sea surface temperatures being so anomalous last year. And I'm curious if deep ocean circulation or changes in the Gulf Stream had anything to do with it.
Sure. This is William Sweet. It's not all thermal expansion. It's circulation, it's changes in winds, it's changes in currents. But the one thing about sea level rise that is not necessarily intuitive, obviously sea levels don't rise like water in a bathtub. So even though sea level has been rising about an inch every 8 years, it's not uniform. But there is extra water, again, two parts melt, one part thermal expansion, but that the currents in the ocean and atmospheric currents blow this water around, you have blobs of more water. And they stack up and they get redistributed due to prevailing winds and currents, as well as ocean heat content as it increases. So it's not just surface water. It's an integrated heat throughout the water column. So it's the warming of water 100 meters, 200 meters, 500, 1,000 meters deep. As it warms, it contributes to this. So it's not always obvious at the surface, like this is much warmer water than always. Though that may be a factor, there's these other contributions and processes involved that aren't always intuitive at a local location. But when you regionally and globally look at it, it's exactly what's being predicted to occur. But that attribution of saying why was it exactly the way it is, that's more of a science research question. But one thing's for certain is the scenarios that we develop and the projections that we provide all are pointing to this type of outcome, and indeed we're seeing it. And so the explanations, will continue to say, how did one particular prevailing storm cause impacts or what have you? But when you sum them up together, this is more or less sea level rise that's being projected to occur and the flooding associated with it. Unfortunately, it's the new normal.
Elizabeth with Reveal, you have our next question, and your line is now open.
Thanks for taking my question. I have two questions. I realized last time I didn't get to do a follow-up. So my question is, do you have some kind of an interactive website or map where communities can see what this means for them in particular? And my second question is, you said that these increases to kind of really alarming levels by 2050, like 75 flooding days, you said, becomes the norm. You said all of that, all the way up to 75 days, is baked in regardless of whether we do anything to restrain climate emissions. And if that's true, what about the future beyond 2050? Could restraint in climate change emissions reduce the number of these flooding days? And why didn't you look further to see the future? Why did you stop at 2050?
This is William Sweet. We do have some tools that do allow you to explore. One is our NOAA Sea Level Rise Viewer and Coastal Flood Mapper. That provides information about our sea level rise projections locally of what those could be in the land exposed at that elevation. We also have another set of products that is these high tide flood outlook that I think is linked in the actual report that you can actually explore all this data that we're talking about today. And in terms of are we baked into this trajectory, the short answer is no. But we're more likely within this range in the next few decades regardless. And you've sort of remembering that we're not necessarily following a smooth trajectory, that there is year-to-year variability, so that those upper numbers may be more indicative of certain years than others, but the tendency to have those higher numbers would relate to higher sea level rise in the lower range. On this case, it would be a quarter foot higher sea level rise by 2050, then the lower range would be, so one would be 1 foot rise globally, the other would be 3/4 foot. Moving beyond 2050, where we do provide our sea level rise scenarios and projections for the United States for risk bounding, emissions matter. Where ice melts matter. There's factors that will cause certain areas that have higher sea level rise than the global average and some that have less, but for most of the United States, it's more. And so really what we're really trying to do at NOAA is we're trying to give communities information that we think is more likely of the shorter-term horizon so that they can plan accordingly, prepare for next year's flooding, what to expect in the next decade or two. But when you get beyond 2050, let's say 2100 and beyond, it's largely emission-dependent. And so that information we do clearly put out there, but it's really we put it out there for risk tolerance. It's an uncertain future, and we don't really know collectively how things are going to pan out, how are humans going to change, if they will at all. But communities, regardless, need to be prepared. And if you have a very low tolerance for risk, like the Army Corps of Engineers, the military, who need to be ready, they may consider higher rates and higher amounts of sea level rise so that they are ready no matter what. If you can't fail, you do not want to expose yourself to risk. And so that's why we provide a range of outcomes, and we don't tell people what is going to happen because we don't know, but we let them be armed with the information so they can make the decision that's best for them in that circumstance.
And this is
thank you. We are
Greg. Oh, I just want to chime in. This is Greg Dusek, and just to make a note too that you know the numbers that we're showing now are based off of the thresholds we have set, which are relative to infrastructure right now as it is on the coast. And so you know, if that infrastructure were to change, then flooding impacts might not be as significant. So I think it's just important to remember that really the impacts, and that's what's important, the impacts of flooding, is that, you know, the natural environment, the water levels as they're reaching now and into the future relative to infrastructure, roads, sidewalks, storm drains, wastewater treatment, infrastructure that as it exists now. And that, you know, that has the potential to be changed.
Thank you. We are coming up on the hour, but I think we have time for just a couple of more questions. And our next question comes from David Abel with the Boston Globe. David, we are opening your line right now.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Okay. Thank you. I had a few questions. First, you had spoken about the increase in sea levels by an inch over every 8 years. Can you say how much it's accelerating now and what it's likely to accelerate in the future? And then I just was hoping that you might be able to walk me through the impacts of high tide flooding on New England, and I haven't had a chance to read the report yet, but I'm looking at the table, and maybe you can explain whether there is or isn't a disproportionate impact so far, what it's likely to be compared to other regions. It looks like it is expected to be higher here than elsewhere. Thank you.
Sure. You know, the acceleration at a local level is always a challenging thing because there's so much variability at the local level. Globally, we have a much, much better handle on the rates of increase of acceleration. And I would point you to the fourth National Climate Assessment that really discussed this and gave sort of the underlying literature. The NASA Sea Level Change Portal is a very nice place where they do a good job at sort of summarizing a lot of the change. At the local level, there are some examples now that are fitting quadratics to mean sea level itself to show in the last 50 years as sea level begin to break away from its linear rate. But in terms of guidance, what we're doing at NOAA now is we are no longer really saying that you know the rates of history of yesterday are the rates to plan on, and so our more likely scenarios of outcomes are somewhere between a half meter and a meter rise globally by 2100. Somewhere within that range is sort of the likely outcomes under continued high emissions or lower emissions. And then how is that manifested locally with vertical land motion, changes in circulation? And we have a website that you can actually look at your community and get that information. And we also overlay the observations relative to the scenarios so folks can get a sense of, you know, what trajectory might they be on, how much interannual variability is occurring, which affects flood risk. So there's a lot of factors that are a little bit more complicated locally to try to tease out any acceleration. We do know that what is accelerating is the rate of high tide flooding, even under linear sea level rise, and that's the way that these impacts play out. In terms of the actual impacts, I would direct you, and we could have a follow-up. You could get in touch with our NOAA comms to the local weather forecast offices in those regions who work with emergency managers who would be the sort of the first line eyes and ears of NOAA as to the types of impacts or where exactly and what areas are at risk, so you could get a better flavor and a better sense of where and what exactly is being impacted. But as a whole, it's stormwater infiltration, it's water coming up out of storm drains into lower-lying areas of water, You can use NOAA's flood exposure mapper to look at the high tide flood threshold map layer and get a sense of, you know, what infrastructure might be within that vicinity. But the actual anecdotal, empirical information, eyes on the ground, that will direct you back to the weather forecasting offices to start that conversation.
Thank you. And I will provide my contact information again right at the end of this call. I think we have time for just one more last question, which is convenient because we have one more person in line. Brian with Bloomberg News, we are opening your line right now for our last question.
Great. You know, you talk about the one-third warmth and the two-thirds ice. What exactly is that driving? And the other question I have for that is, you know, one-third, two-third, that's all climate change, isn't it?
The one-third, two-third, the two-thirds of the ice melt, that rate's picked, it used to not be the two-third, and that's changed over the last couple decades. And that's being measured from a host of NOAA, NASA satellites, and in-situ measurements. That is anticipated as part of this climate change signal. And that is obviously why we're measuring it and making these measurements and providing these projections and overlaying the two of them. The projections themselves have an underlying basis to them that would have a climate signal to them inherent to the modeling. So I would direct you again back to the Fourth National Climate Assessment. But what is being predicted under all the models is continued warming of ocean and atmospheric, continued absorption of that heat into the ocean, which is going to continue to drive that thermal expansion. But the large wild card is the amount of ice melt that is occurring and may occur in the future at much greater rates, getting us to those higher amounts. And that's why these observations and continued modeling and understanding of the climate system is so important, so that we have a better idea of what could happen. And if it could, you know, how do we convey this information to folks so that they can, you know, determine their risk tolerance and plan accordingly?
Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for joining our call. The report we've been talking about and other materials like imagery and our press release are available on our website. You can also access them through the link in the NOAA press release, which is on the NOAA.gov website. And it was also sent to your news teams today, so you should have it that way as well. If you do have any other questions as you're pulling your stories together, please reach out to me at Jenny, J-E-N-N-I-E, .Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, at NOAA, N-O-A-A, .gov with your inquiry and the deadline that you're working under. Again, that's Jenny with an I-E, .Lyons, at NOAA.gov. You can also reach me on the phone at 202-603-9372. Again, that is 202-603-9372. And with that, we will go ahead and close this call. Thank you all very much for your time today.
Today's conference has concluded. You may disconnect at this time.